Welcome to the Consulting Growth Podcast. I'm Professor Joe Omani, a professor of consulting at Cardiff University and an advisor to consultancies that want to grow. If you'd like to find more out about me and access some free resources to help your consultancy grow, do please visit joeomani.com. That's joeomahoney.com. Okay, thank you for joining us. I am very excited today to have someone on the podcast who I've been looking forward to talking to for some time now. I've got Dr. Jeff Smart, who is the founder and chairman of GH Smart, which is a leadership development company and has been highly successful, has been going for some time now. Jeff, welcome to the podcast.
It's a great pleasure to be here, Professor.
I won't call you doctor and you don't call me professor and we'll call it quits.
Sounds good. It's a deal.
Could you please give us a brief history of how you got to where you are today?
Sure. So how I got to where we are today. So in the beginning, I was a grunt working in a private equity firm in Chicago, Illinois, in the USA, crunching numbers and evaluating potential investments for my bosses. But what struck me was, and this is, I was an undergraduate at the time at Northwestern University studying economics. And what struck me was they said, you know what? It's not just what we invest in that matters most. It's who we invest in. And I thought, well, that's interesting. So why are we spending all of our time focusing on the products and the financials and the markets, right? So this need for high-end leadership advisory and analytics, specifically in the venture capital space, was kind of the early genesis of the idea for GH Smart. My father had a PhD in industrial and organizational psychology. He had a one-person consulting show, him and an assistant. That's my growing up years. I'd listen to him counseling executives on hiring and developing their talent. So I was very aware of that little sub-niche field. But to my knowledge, it had never been really applied into this big world of finance to put basically like the money and the people parts of deals together with a bit more surgical precision. So the genesis of GH Smart was age 17, did this internship, saw a need in the market. Age 21, went off to graduate school, studied with Peter Drucker, the great, Peter Drucker. He was at Claremont out in Los Angeles. And so I just got a straight up psychology master's and PhD, but all my classwork and my dissertation were around business psychology questions. And specifically my dissertation, which then turned into our firm, was looking at how venture capitalists evaluate the people part of an investment that they're planning to make. And I correlated it with the returns that they made on their deals and found a giant finding. So as you know, being in academia and research, like a high quantity of subjects, small effect, still gets published in the academic journals, right? Well, this is a kind of medium-sized sample of 76 different venture capital firms and a whole bunch of their deals. But the effect that I discovered was huge. Venture capitalists who spent the most time and sort of following a disciplined process for evaluating the people part of a deal achieved 4 times the returns of those who didn't.
Wow.
So it's a huge finding. And so I just basically decided to start consulting on it. So I went from student to consultant in the flash of an eye and actually started GH Smart 2 years before I finished my doctoral program.
Wow. Gosh, that's impressive. And well, it's impressive on many counts. The first is having a useful PhD, which,
right?
Even in a business school, yeah. I'd say that probably in 5% of cases is a PhD actually acted upon post-PhD rather than just simply turned into academic papers.
Sure. And it's good advice I give PhD students all the time, you might as well, which is go find a really great data set, find an interesting unasked question, and for gosh sake, don't reinvent the wheel and have to worry about necessarily collecting a full fresh new data set. I did not follow that advice. I used the 2 or 3 years that I did to do the study to meet my prospective market, to have conversations intimately about how they evaluated the people part of the deal and what their biggest fears were and concerns and problems around making bets on people and then helping those leaders put together talented teams and grow valuable businesses.
Okay, this is so pertinent to so many of my own clients, but also listeners of this podcast, who they might have a consulting firm where they've started off with a couple of founders, perhaps brought in a couple of partners. They've got to 50 people, they're looking to exit. And sometimes their leadership teams are wanting a little bit, and they're the only people they could have got, perhaps at the time. I'm not disparaging any of them, because there's some very able leaders there. But you look at some individuals and you think, if we started where we are now, you probably wouldn't have got recruited.
Right. I mean, so founding team to professional management and the transitions throughout the different stages of growth, I think are difficult, but not that difficult if you just expect that the people that you have at the very beginning, some of them will scale, some of them will find very specific, I'm making a gesture of narrowness here as sure. Joe and I are talking and facing each other. But like, as you grow the firm, someone who was rainmaking and leading operations and, you know, helping advise on some part of the back office and finance and administration, and maybe doing a little HR in their free time. Over time, some folks will then say, oh, really good at the rainmaking part. I think I'll spend more time on that. And they can scale with the business. Or some folks don't scale with the business. And that's fine too. I think it's a weird thing in global entrepreneurship, the thought that it's bad or shameful that people are good fits for different stages of growth of any business. So, and if the founders who recognize that are the ones who can go the distance and who can stick around longer, and the ones who just kind of cling to an initial team or initial concept and are unwilling to adapt and grow and bring in the fresh new talent to fulfill new strategic needs as the business grows, they sort of flatten out and or don't have as much upside potential. But yeah, we've done two entire senior team successions, full 100%. Everybody's new from 1995 when I founded the business in 95. Today in 2023, we have 180 full-time GH Smart folks in five countries around the US. And you know, we're growing about 20% a year. And we've had two managing partners after me, Randy Street in 2009, 10x'd the business until 2021. So he did a great job as managing partner. He's now our vice chairman. He's still with us. I'm still with us. I'm the chairman and founder. And then Jeff McLean now is the second president to run the business. And both Randy changed out my operating team and Jeff changed out Randy's operating team. So the senior leadership team of folks who have full day jobs of management are totally new at each one of these different stages. The partners haven't been around a long time. Lots of them have been here, 10 or 20 years even. But the operating leadership has to change at different stages of growth of the business.
Okay. So you practice what you preach, obviously.
Yes.
It's not just all talk, is it?
No, that's right. We don't do everything perfectly. Hiring, I'd say we're especially good at around succession and being just humble and honest about what our strengths and weaknesses are, and therefore, who are the key hires we need for this next stage of growth. I think we've navigated those waters fairly well.
I'd like to ask you two chunks of questions. One is about the growth of your own firm, which is obviously a great success story and very interesting. But before we get into that, I just wanted to ask your opinion on some leadership challenges I see with, especially in professional services. And the first one we've kind of turned around already, which is that you need different leadership teams and perhaps even different leadership styles for different strategic challenges that come with growth. What I see with some of my clients is that you've kind of got this group of founders or senior people, and they're looking for jobs to do. So one will kind of take on HR stuff because he likes people, and another one will take on finance because they're good with numbers. And then they typically get to a size where you need the professionals to come in. You need someone who actually has CIPD accreditation or has been there and done that. But then equity becomes an issue. Two things become an issue, actually. One is equity, but the other is psychology. And in some ways, some partners, because they've got their position, because they're in there so early, they feel like they should be doing something important when actually perhaps they're just good at delivery. Is that something you've come across? And in which case, how do you manage the psychology of some of these transitions?
I really appreciate that, because you're working with people's own psychology about what success means and what they expected to be doing in their careers and what they want to do. And then also just kind of convention, which is like bigger titles are better and smaller titles are worse, or narrower title, right? So let's think about, I mean, try to think of specific examples as we've gone. We've had, I'll see here. It's a big question. Lots is coming up for me over the years as I've had all these conversations with folks. But I think a general principle is trying to help people find their dream job is always a good idea. And so if it's senior folks, and we had a couple senior people around my first handoff to have someone other than the founder managing the business, we talked fairly openly about who should run the business. And interestingly, some of the senior rainmaking types, others were looking to, oh, you know, maybe you should run the business. They didn't want to, right? So they like rainmaking, they like advising clients. They didn't want to do the quote unquote administrative part of running the business. It was my youngest partner and least tenured partner at the time, Randy Street, who said, I mean, he wasn't like vying for the job, but he said, I would consider doing it if you all think I'm a good match. And he was a great match. He was a Harvard MBA, a Bainey. He'd been at Bain for about 8 years, 9 years, and then was in a senior operating role in a real company where he grew this thing very well. So he had the kind of operating background. He had the steady cadence, very brilliant, but willing to listen. I mean, he really, if he'd like listed out all the ideal characteristics of a managing partner, he really had it. So we all kind of threw convention out, and rather than just like have the current biggest name or biggest dollar partner be the president, what made more sense was the person who fit the criteria the best would be named president. So that's one thought. Another one is we've had some mid-senior colleagues over the years who've said things like, I'm tired of doing this kind of work. I want to stay at the firm, but like, I'm not happy. And that doesn't mean that they're a bad person or even a low performer. These are, you know, talented, wonderful people. So just taking a blank sheet of paper conversation with someone and saying, what does an ideal job look like to you, where you get to do what you're great at and you don't have to do the things you don't like, you're not great at? And a number of times we've had really talented colleagues we've saved and have slotted into a needed role and where they could really play to their strengths, you know, with most of the hours in the week. So yeah. I feel good about those cases. But I think there's a huge difference, as you mentioned, between the client-facing consulting team and the operating leaders who are really good at their functional areas. And that's a mindset shift that we all have to go through in professional services, as you pointed out. But like, sooner is better than later. We had a client who yelled at me once, very early days, because I was sending out invoices from my desk, right? It was back in the day of printing and, you know, sending out on, I can't remember if we FedExed or snail mailed invoices, but my client, Kevin, who is a very senior private equity investor out of Lazard in New York, what kind of a popcorn stand are you running over there? Are you personally sending me invoices? And I said, yes, Kevin. And he said, well, how about this? Why don't you hire a CFO who can kind of handle all the back office stuff so you can have more time being client facing? And I thought, well, okay, that sounds like a pretty good idea. So this was very early, sub 10 million revenue. We hired a full blast CFO, which felt expensive at the time. But if you pay people a decent base and have variable comp that goes bigger based on, you know, growth and hitting metrics, you can afford adult great talent. Yeah. And we've had wonderful men and women come into our firm at different stages who are a little bit kind of bigger than the firm was at the time, but knew how to pull us up in finance or marketing or HR, et cetera. But those key functional leader hires, I don't see my peers out there in professional service land putting as much emphasis on as they should.
It must warm your heart, actually, when you see that, when you come, I mean, we will both come across firms, especially in professional services, and you go in and your job is to improve performance at the end of the day. And you look at the senior leadership team, and perhaps they've got 100 people and they haven't got a CFO and they haven't got a chief people officer. Perhaps they don't have anyone in marketing. And you think, well, there's some fairly, okay, so we're talking investment, but there's some fairly quick wins here in terms of, I guess it's part of a bigger package of professionalizing the roles and responsibilities of the entire organization.
Yes. And I don't think it means that the culture has to get dodgy or overly formal or bureaucratic. That's all, for some reason, that seems to be the counter argument to really professionalizing the firm. I mean, hire amazing people who fit the culture, who happen to be great at that functional area. I'm of the perception, and our research and practice sort of supports this, which is we're all good at actually a kind of narrow set of things. Yep. Like, no one's good at 25 things. Like, at best, we're good at about two things or maybe three things. So if you can hire people who are really good at the things that need to get done, they can fit the culture. You can still have a lot of fun and be a very caring, not family-like, because that to me implies a lack of meritocracy, more nepotism over meritocracy, but a very collegial, upbeat, great culture. You can still have that and even have that more in spades if you hire great professionals in their areas to help do their part to keep the firm growing versus over-relying on consultants in their free time to do a functional area. bad idea, been there, done that, or not having a key functional area covered by someone who's a real pro at it.
Yep. Okay. I'm really hoping there's a couple of my old clients listening. There was a wonderful phrase you said there, which was, idea you gave over about professionalization doesn't mean bureaucracy.
That's right.
When I've suggested leadership changes or leadership change, two specific clients, and if they're listening to this, they'll know who they are, came back and said, well, you know, we're not a bureaucracy. We want to be nimble. We want to be quick. We want to be innovative. And my view is, well, you would do that a lot better if you had decent role definitions.
Yes, that's right. Mm. Here's an example of a big mistake we made on my watch as when I was running the firm day to day, that an academic pointed out for us. I'll even say who it was because it was all positive. Bob Kagan at Harvard came in as a consultant for a day to help us identify, this sounds a little wonky to your listeners, but it ended up being very useful to identify, what was it, hidden assumptions we were making culturally about our business that were holding us back. And so what was funny is it was supposed to take like 7 hours. In the first hour, he's like rubbing his temples, listening to us talk and answer his questions and have us, you know, great, you know, session of introspection. And he said, all right, look, he's like, I've already figured it out. So can we just jump to the part where I tell you what the hidden assumption is that you're making that's holding you back? And we all sort of like, you know, took a deep breath and we were ready to receive his wisdom. And he said, what I'm hearing here is if you have a very, very high bar for hiring people into GH Smart, they don't really need training because they come pre-trained. And I jump up and sort of say, yes, right? And he's like, no. I said, yeah, that's the assumption you're making, but no one's fully trained. No one's pre-trained. Yep. Yes, you need training, for example. So what was a lack of bureaucracy, but minus a good professional development function turned into, goodness, we really do need to give our new folks a good running start on their onboarding, sharing methodologies and helping accelerate their learning. The mid-level or mid-tenure people, well, they need to learn the next level, you know, client management and business development stuff. And then even the partners have been here for a while. We're trying to pioneer a new niche in this industry of very high-end leadership consulting for private equity people and billionaire entrepreneurs and governments. It's like, and that, a lot of this stuff hadn't been really done before. So we're all learning. So we all need professional development. So that was the toggle from nobody great needs training to everybody needs training. And then we hired a professional development pro and built out that function. It didn't become bureaucratic where we're all sitting in classrooms with our eyes glazing over as we're being trained on standard operating procedures. Yeah. It's not like that. I think that's what I thought it was going to be like.
Okay.
Instead, it was a highly customized approach to being more deliberate about learning and knowing what we need folks to learn and really being building a culture of learning, which was super, super helpful and made us more nimble and innovative, as you mentioned, than before. We were just kind of repeating what we had already learned.
This is the first conversation I think I've ever had where Kagan and Drucker have been mentioned as people
yes.
who actually interacted with it, which is incredible.
Yeah, actual people. Yeah. But Drucker gave me an A minus for the GH Smart business plan, by the way. He didn't give it an A or an A plus. And the reason was he thought that the idea in the market of having a very high-end firm doing leadership assessment and development, that made sense. He's like, that worked. He's like, but I don't know how you're going to get the colleagues, the people to join your company. As he said, with this tough love, you know, very deep accent, you know, sort of like, you don't know anything, know anybody, and no one's going to join your company. He said that I kind of felt bad about it. And then I thought, all right, well, yeah, I turned it around. What is the kind of company that someone who's a top quartile performer out of McKinsey or Bain or BCG or another great firm would want to, you know, leave that behind in order to join us here, or top psychologists? And so it really did put the pressure on to, you know, craft a culture that was worth joining. So thanks, Peter Drucker. He did die about 3 years after I founded GH Smart, and we hadn't yet hit it quite yet. So, you know, you never knew, you know, just how successful it ended up becoming. But yeah, we have Drucker, we have Kagan. And if I have any other good names to drop, I'll try to think of them before the end of the interview.
Well, listen, that leads nicely on to my next question, which is leadership development. I could throw a stone out my window, and I'm not in the countryside, and I could probably hit a leadership development coach or trainer. But
yes,
GH Smart is a different kettle of fish. You have, you've developed a highly premium offering, working with some of the top companies in the world at the most senior levels.
Yes.
Acting as Drucker now, how on earth did you do that from PhD student to getting into the boardrooms of companies which most consultants would cut off their right arms to have some of those conversations.
Well, I appreciate that. I think that the skill, so I think it's two things. There's a number of things probably, but two things come to mind on how they have sort of the top of that org chart, CEOs, people who run or own large organizations, how to make them client. Okay, one is you have to decide that is your client that you're going after. So everything we do at GH Smart from the very beginning, keep in mind, before I even started the firm, the PhD dissertation was on how private equity and venture capital investors make better bets on people. Like, so that was the target from the beginning. That helped, actually. Henry Kravis, is that name familiar?
Yeah,
KKR, right? So he was a graduate of Claremont. He went to undergrad there, you know, decades before I was there doing my PhD. So number one is deciding to focus on the top. Two is having the courage to not worry about failure or being told no. For example, I called Henry Kravis's assistant to try to get him into my dissertation study, right? And he was my first call. Hey, this is Jeff Smart. I'm at Claremont where Mr. Kravis donated a building, as far as I can tell, to the Kravis Leadership Institute. May I interview him for my study? And I got told no four times by his assistant, Angela. I remember it like it was yesterday. I can name names because that was 30 years ago. But anyway, so she was, you know, she's doing her job as a gatekeeper, said no, no, thank you. Nope, nope, nope. So I sent a little message over just describing the study. And he said, yes, then. And then once he was in, everybody else wanted to join in and be in the study. They were going to get a copy of the results and all this kind of jazz. So another principle here you're hearing is, you know, not taking no for an answer, but also once you get one, you've got 10.
Yep.
So, you know, that kind of thing. Then you have to just do good work. Like, so getting in is scary and hard and you try and you get told no a lot. But once you get one of these CEOs or big titans of industry, you just have to do really great work. And then the circles that they travel in and their co-investors and the people who they interact with, that you interact with, if you're consulting with them, and through word of mouth is sort of how that spread. So in the very early days, I think it was just a decision to focus on the most influential leaders being the target client, and then trying hard and not worrying too much when they say no. We had a couple of lucky bounces. We had a billionaire tech CEO read an article in a weird magazine and call us up and say, like, you know, hey, we're interested in professionalizing our management team. We'd like to use a more systematic approach. And so I remember, you know, getting this call. I was still working on my dissertation at the time. I wasn't even out of grad school. A Fortune 500 large tech company head of HR was calling to say, like, hey, we'd like to talk to GH Smart about doing some work. And I played hard to get. I hope no clients are listening right now. This is just for your listeners, just for your fellow, you know, brothers and sisters in professional services. But I played a bit hard to get. I said, you know, oh, well, thank you for your call. We are quite busy and we're not currently taking on new clients, which was true because I was just almost done with the dissertation and I had two clients that were taking up most of my time. I was vaguely aware of this client. I knew who they were, an attractive client, but I didn't want to sound desperate. So they said, oh, and you're not going to believe this next part. You will think I'm not telling the truth on this next part. Joe, I said, they said, well, if you'd like to come up here, meet with the HR department, you know, we'd love to have a chat. And I said, oh, that's kind. I said, I really don't have time for that. But if your CEO wants to fly to me in Chicago, I would meet him for 30 minutes. Just listen, I was 25 years old, pre-PhD, and I had GH Smart for 2 whole years. And we're just doing little projects with whoever would hire us. So the guy couldn't believe it. He was, what? Anyway, the next day, I got a call from the assistant saying, like, oh, yeah, so-and-so wants to come visit you. And so so-and-so came and visited. I picked him up at the FBO as he stepped off his private jet. And we had about a three-hour meeting just talking about what he was trying to do just to make better people decisions at the senior level, and did the work. On that one, that was so early. I called my dad in for support for some gray hair in the room. So I'm 24, 25. My dad was like 50 something, right? And so I was like, Dad, I need you to just be in this meeting. Okay. So it was a fun collab. It was I think we shared maybe two or three very early clients in GH Smart's history where I'd call in my dad and come sit in the room, and together, you know, it was a wonderful father-son bonding opportunity, but we had fun advising this client for about 5 or 6 years. And it was a great experience, but that's another, I don't know, what do you call it? Swagger or confidence or something. But I did sense that the folks at the top of the house, you know, have a lot of people trying to work with them. And if they sense that you have something special, also last thing, we guaranteed client satisfaction with the work from the very beginning. And that was just feeling like, I don't know, like I would feel bad if we charged a bunch of money for something and the client didn't like it. And also it allowed me to keep my GH Smart colleagues honest on making sure we're always giving value, because I would just tell them, hey, look, if they don't like it, we're getting the feedback, and then you have to cough up your portion of it. So let's make sure our clients are happy. So that's another ninja tactic for serving the top of the house, is the quality has to be super duper high. And so if you charge a lot, but you guarantee the client's happiness, it makes them a little less afraid to try out the service.
Yeah, and it builds on that confidence. You're looking confident in your product, you're acting confident. I love that story. That's incredible, isn't it?
Thank you. And today it seems irresponsible and kind of incredible, but at the time it was funny. It was a combination of, this is an attractive client, so let's play a little bit hard to get. But also, I mean, I was just like actually busy. I didn't want to go up there and get stuck talking to the direct report of the direct report to the direct report of the head of HR. I just didn't want to. It was a bit of practicality. But today, same thing. So basically, doing quality work is like 95% of it, I think, because the word spreads, and then the CEOs talk to each other and they'll refer you and you'll get tons of work. So that's the main way to sustain top of the house client base. But getting them to begin with, any kind of guerrilla tactics to even get the meeting, I think requires a bit of thick skin to not worry about being told no. I've been told no many more times than being told yes. And at some point, if you're okay with that, I think it relieves some of the stress of really trying to go for it into serving the biggest clients.
And kind of following on from that question, you're quite dominant in, there's a very specific niche you've got there.
Yes.
You're pretty dominant in that niche. Was that always a strategy? Did you think you would be as successful as you have been? Or has this from the beginning, or has this been sort of an emergent strategy as you went along?
Yeah. What's funny is, so the niche you're talking about is in the world of private equity. We brought management assessment and high-end leadership coaching into that space. None of those early clients had another provider that they were trying to kick out. Like it was a do-it-yourself kind of thing, right? Private equity people. In fact, this giant private equity firm that's based in Washington, D.C. in the USA had us in to a partner meeting on a Monday. And there's all these, maybe 15 partners in this giant mahogany boardroom. And then on the flat screens, there's Tokyo, Shanghai, Paris, London. Wow. And it's a little nerve-wracking. And one of them, and the point of the meeting was for us to basically pitch our services around doing management due diligence services for them when they're thinking about making an investment. And one of the partners on the TV said, hold on a second, I thought we're supposed to be good at evaluating management teams, as a reason why they wouldn't want to use us. And do you remember those Polycom things, the voice box, the speaker microphone right in front of me? And I dramatically reached out to it and I tapped it. I said, boom, boom, boom. I said, sorry, I didn't know if I caught that audio. Did you say that this organization is good at evaluating management, or you're supposed to be good at evaluating management? There was about a half second where my heart was just like stopped beating. And then everybody in the room and on the TV started laughing. Everyone was saying, all right, fair enough. We could always get better at this. I said, well, fair enough. And that's what our other clients want to take it from 80% accurate to 90-95% accurate in their evaluations of management teams. So the founder, billionaire founder of this giant private equity firm, scribbles a note and puts it down. He was sitting right next to me and walks out of the room. And I like pick up the note. And it says specific suggestion, colon, raise your prices.
And how Joe, wonderful.
Clearly the best day in business any entrepreneur in professional services could possibly imagine is like taking a bit of a high risk tactic, landing the business, and then having the founder say, we'd like to pay more for this. Yeah. And I literally have no idea why he wrote that. Like, why would they want to pay more? I think he was like saying, look, you're early and you're learning about this stuff, but your peer groups charge way more than you do. So you guys need to just like, and we did, we took it as advice. We charged, we increased our pricing so much that we actually bled off about 20% of our low end client in order to make capacity for the high end. We just kind of ratcheted up the client base from that moment forward. And that was a solid 10 years after founding though. That wasn't like on day two.
Okay, I'm hoping that post-it is framed somewhere.
Yes, it is. It's at my main house in Denver, Colorado. It is for sure framed. I would show it to you next time we chat if I'm back home.
Wow, that's amazing. And I'm guessing that shift also helped you. I guess that was 2005-ish.
Correct.
I'm guessing that shift also helped you because your margins are going to be higher. The expectations of people is going to be higher. I'm guessing that freed up a little bit of money to get in more senior people, perhaps, or I don't know.
Yeah, it was more of like adding the professional staff with the big capital outlays. You're hiring more people in finance, hiring our first CHRO around that time, building out the professional development capabilities at the firm so we could train our people. It was a lot of that. What else do we use money for in the early? Yeah, I mean, it was just, and being able to just maximize on people's incomes so we could continue to tell folks that we're, you know, you can come here, make a lot of impact, make a lot of money, and, you know, have more freedom and flexibility in your calendar, your schedule, as than what you might be used to. So yeah, it was a genuine interest to do impactful work. We also from the very beginning, we never had offices. So I started the company when I was a grad student. We didn't have any money. I didn't want to go raise a bunch of money. So no offices. So we were remote, not starting in COVID, but starting in 1995. Oh. So it was right around the time when your mobile phone started becoming an accepted business practice where you could talk on the phone, send emails for the first time ever. So, I mean, the way it played out was we would charge the high rates after our one client told us to, and we matched sort of MBB rates. So high rates, very low SG&A because we didn't have offices.
Yep.
And then we could just basically pay people more and then attract the best and brightest to come on over and do this work. So that was kind of a virtuous cycle. And then it wasn't until later years that then we'd peel off real chunks of free cash flow to open an international office or invest in a new product suite and that kind of thing.
Yep. So many questions firing off in my head. One of them is the most trite question you can imagine, that you're probably better placed than anyone in the world to answer it. And you'd have seen Harvard Business Review articles on this. And that is the born or bred question. And I come across some leaders and I think no matter how many training courses I put you through, you're not going to do this. There's a big mindset block. It might even go back to your childhood. Whereas others, you kind of think, well, listen, if we upped you a bit on business development skills or communications, is that a view that you would share? Or are you a believer that you can make a leader out of anyone given enough time?
No. Yeah, let's think about this for a second. So I've evolved a little bit in my thinking from thinking that it was almost entirely born, not bred. And as a result of born, not bred, our early products were all assessment oriented, like just pick the right winner, right? Yeah. People can't develop. So your whole job as a CEO, as a senior person, is to select the right person. So that was both an assumption and product set, and in culturally at GH Smart that Bob Kagan pointed out was the assumption. So since then, I think what I've seen in just out in client land as well as internally at GH Smart is people can learn and do learn in categories that are learnable. But I think there are some categories that are less learnable. So it's a tricky discussion to try to figure out. I think the question is front center when it's around hiring someone. Hey, here's some strength areas, but they've got a couple weaker areas. Are they coachable in those areas or not? And then also just around if someone's underperforming, you know, was that a hiring mistake or can the person learn and grow and perform well? So I'm still, if I used to be honestly like 95%, 5% on born versus bred, I really think there's a high natural sort of set of behavioral inclinations that kind of come with somebody. I'd say I'm sort of 70-30 today. I think there's a lot of innate qualities that aren't very changeable over time that predict or suggest why you behave how you do, but a solid 30% of things are learnable. So the things that are hardwired that we don't see people change a whole lot is like actually work ethic. Weirdly, you'd think, can't you just work harder? No, people are kind of hardworking people and like less hardworking people. So like we have this thing, this potential model we use at GH Smart now with some of our clients has the drive. It's kind of like EQ matters, right? Emotional awareness. Some of that's hardwired. Some of it, sure, you can say things to make you sound more extroverted if you're an extreme introvert, that kind of thing. But generally EQ, at least half of it is fairly hardwired. I think drive, about half of it, or more fairly hardwired. And then cognitive skills, different from EQ, different from drive, G, just intelligence, like just raw brain power. Not everybody can do, 10 digit division in their heads. Even with practice, I just don't think they do. So I'd say a lot of it is hardwired. Knowing what we're hardwired to be good at and find fulfillment and enjoyment doing is part of the fun, I think, of offering folks career strategy advice. But an area for improvement is an area that's learnable. Technical skills, learnable. Public speaking skills, learnable. People who, senior executive president skills, very learnable, that kind of thing. But, you have some like honesty stuff and integrity, a little bit less learnable, hard work ethic, and to a great extent, introversion, extroversion. I will say some of our research on CEO success suggests that by a slight margin, introverts actually outperform extroverts in the C-suite. So like this whole idea that people who interview well and who are really fun to talk with, you'd want to spend a day on a plane with. Careful, you got to like check some of those assumptions because actually the introverts outperform the extroverts. So anyway, yeah, I'd say overall 70-30, born versus developable.
Okay, thank you. That's a nice clear answer with justified reasons. I saw the research on the introverts and extroverts, and I thought that was really interesting. Yeah. I think there'd be a nice no one has time for this, but I think there'd be a nice international study to see if it held around the world, different emphases and things.
Agree. That's very important for us right now as a firm because we're in the US, UK, Germany, Canada, and we just are opening our first Asia Pacific office out of Sydney, Australia, of all places right now. And so, you know, we're going to climb up the Pacific Rim and also, you know, spread it throughout continental Europe and then get a Latin America, Middle East and Africa strategy. And yeah, it's kind of one of these things where does leadership matter everywhere? Yes. Okay. Well, that's pretty broad. Okay. Well, does selecting good leaders and developing good leaders, is that important everywhere? Yeah, mostly, except for some of the regions of the world that are highly family oriented and just family businesses and, you know, governments and families and all that kind of stuff where maybe bloodline is more important than talent. But then as you get into it, like, how do you evaluate a leader in one culture? How do you develop someone the right way that fits that culture? Wonderful questions. We will continue to research and learn from the School of Hard Knocks. I don't think brash Americans should go all over the world, you know, having a one-size-fits-all approach to assessing and developing talented teams.
I learned that lesson the hard way when I was a corporate consultant working. I rolled things out around the world and I learned very quickly that what works in the US and the UK doesn't work in Japan or Thailand.
Yes, absolutely. There's a version of communication and culture and norms and that kind of thing. And once you crack that code, then you can, you know, start to convert practices into the culturally relevant way of expressing them.
Jeff, I run a boutique leaders group, and it's sort of about 30 of us that get together each month and just chat about leadership challenges. And I told them I was chatting to you, and many of them got very excited, and they gave me a long list of questions they wanted to ask, but I've kind of whittled it
down. Let's do a lightning round. Brilliant. We'll do quick answers. Give the people what they want.
Number one, you get great client feedback. How do you strike a balance between getting great actionable data from clients and not taking too much of their time up?
Yeah, I appreciate that. What came up for me with that question is collecting client data in the course of doing work and service of the client, I think is fine. So thoroughness is good. If clients feel like the data collection is tangential or not part of the work you're doing for them, they get less excited about it. But if you're basically like, hey, look, you know, in order to get to the right answer here and really have the very best insights, yes, we need 4 hours of your time and 3 hours of their time and to get these groups of people together. And you have to be fairly directive about the data collection that you need in order to arrive at the answer. We just had this done to us. We hired a branding firm. I couldn't believe how thorough they were. Come up with a new logo and some new words to describe what we do for different client segments. They were so thorough. It's called Agenda out of New York. If anyone wants to have a branding firm that really does an unbelievable amount of work. You know, it didn't bother me as the client because I sensed that it was out of their spirit of trying to achieve excellence. Mm-hmm. If it feels academic or if they're like, I have been yelled at, we do a client satisfaction survey every 6 months to all of our clients. I remember the head of HR of a big private equity firm yelled at me, you know, I don't have time to fill this out. And I was like, hey, look, it's two questions. The first question is, how happy are you with our services? And you have like 5-point, very, whatever, yeah, rate the value of the services. And outstanding, very good, good, poor, very poor. And then like explain. It's two questions. Like it'll take you no time or a little bit of time. And if you have a special request, you know, there's a way that you can, you know, communicate it kind of thing. So I've gotten slapped down a little bit on client satisfaction data collection. But if the data collection is specifically advancing the question the client's trying to answer, you can be pretty bold about asking for as much time as you want.
Okay, thank you. Number two.
Yeah.
The business is still synonymous with you as an individual, but has clearly scaled way beyond you. How did you manage building the business beyond you to create scale?
Remember like it was yesterday. Three things happened all at one time. The recession of 2009 was stressful. We were off about 20% in revenue. I was still managing the business. So from 1995 to 2009, I managed it day to day. Number two, I was at a Young Presidents Organization, YPO event. I was a member of it. And someone who had scaled a great business said, you have to realize that in order to scale your business, you have to work on your business, not in your business. And I thought, oh, I think I get it. Oh, I totally get it. And then number three is we had talented people who could run the business better than I could. So it was a decision at that point that I was going to hire or promote, in this case, a president to run the business. That president told me I wasn't allowed to show up at partner meetings. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it would undermine his authority. He told me, like, I'll give you any information you want. Just tell me what information you want. But you can't like call me and bug me constantly and like breathe down my neck. I thought, okay. So that was good on his part, was smart advice. And then he was like, yeah, look, if I'm hitting the numbers, then like we're going to have a great relationship and I'll call you if I need anything, but I don't need a whole lot of direction. Thank you very much. And I said, that's fair. And so, yeah, we had a wonderful 12-year run. He was the managing partner, Randy Street. We co-wrote the Who book together, by the way, before that all started. So had a great run. He's vice chairman today. He does partner development. He does rainmaking. He does all this great stuff, but he doesn't have to run the day-to-day because guess what? COVID burned him out. Like the 2009 recession burned me out. And he said, you know what? After running this thing for 12 years, let's give it to someone else. So I'd say you can't run the business and expect leadership and innovation to happen. I think. And so what do you do then? What do you do? Well, what you do is be the chairman and founder or a senior person, and you let the person who's running the business run the business. They run the meetings. They are in the partner meetings. They do all the Monday morning communication to the firm. They do the spotlight leader stuff. They're the leader, and you have to let them be the leader. And you shut up and you sit in the back and you smile and nod and you advise them from behind. And sure, you've got decision rights on budget. You've got a lot of power still, but you're letting other people, you know, do their job to run the business. So I think being very careful on selection, being very willing to delegate, and then look for ways to add value. So I still do branding and business development and recruiting work, but like kind of grunt work stuff. Like I like that stuff. So I'll work with small teams on like our brand refresh. I'll work with small teams on the recruiting side to bring people into our business or other special creative projects. We did a big DE&I thing that I kind of helped get going about 5 years ago, which was a lot of fun. So yeah, you can have a nice variety of jobs to do, but managing the business isn't one of them once you name the successors and the appointed leaders to manage the business.
Again, I really hope there's a different couple of clients listening to this because they, and they'll know who they are, they have appointed CEOs and they are all over the CEO in terms of figures and updates and micromanaging and all the rest of it. It's not a solution for a happy life, let alone an effective company.
I think that's right. And it takes a weird amount of trust, but like trust but verify, as our late Ronald Reagan said in America, is a wonderful way to do it in that kind of relationship. But you definitely can't micromanage. Like a Marshall Goldsmith's book, What Got You Here Won't Get You There, comes to mind, where he identifies 20 behavioral derailers that senior executives make mistakes around, and adding too much information or like wanting to micromanage and constantly critique and guide people too closely is a very common challenge. But yeah, it's so much better to put your energy into hiring the right people and then let them do their job. Warren Buffett said it, which is hire well, manage little. And I really like that quote. It really fits our WHO philosophy.
And also, if you're managing the culture as well, then that means that you don't have to micromanage. Yeah, great.
Okay. Right.
So the third question I had, and this is the penultimate one, is, and this is quite a big one, but if you could give advice to your younger self when starting and growing the company, I guess it's a question about what would you do differently, but what advice would you give that younger
gentleman? Yeah, I'll start with differently, and I'll throw in a couple of would done it the same also. Differently, number three things. One is our using digital technology was way too late. So we were innovative in 1995 by using cell phones and email and PowerPoint. And we were like, you know, Microsoft's like early adopters. So we used new and emerging technology back in the 90s. There have been several shifts in technology that would have been helpful tools for us that we've just sort of been too, I don't know, like we've felt like we've been above it. Oh, they, you know, we have such a senior clientele, you know, they need the white glove service. Like we don't need all this technology, but I think that was a miss. We've been reinvesting just heavily in recent years to catch up and leapfrog our folks who are out there, competitors who are doing a good job of using data analytics and tools and just communication tools, that kind of thing. So more technology earlier, more robust there. I would have given my earlier self that, like, diversity, equity, and inclusion, I think has always been a value. I think we've really cranked it up in the last 5 to 10 years at our firm, both because of the work we do in the client side is very impactful in this area of like helping clients be more inclusive and representative. And then just internally, 53% of our partners are women. Great. Like, you know, that's weird. Oh, yeah. So that's rare in consulting. And, you know, we have a really diverse, we were just named number one most diverse consulting firm by Vault for this year, for 2023, out of 70,000 companies. So I don't know, like, I feel good about that. Like, today it's great, but like, we could have gotten started earlier. We just like, it wasn't on the radar screen as early. And then three, international expansion. I mean, I think we've been at a disadvantage relative to larger consulting firms who don't do exactly what we do, but who do similar things to what we do. We can take care of international clients, global clients who are all over the place. And we've been, you know, we were more North American focused until just a few years ago. So I would have gotten going on having just one outpost in Europe, Asia, South America, Middle East, Africa earlier. So I'd say those three would be the should have done them earlier. And then what we wouldn't have changed, I wouldn't change who the client is, which is CEO. Cut that. I wouldn't have changed just the mind-numbing amount of work we go through to hire the very best talent in the company. Like, it's a lot of extra work to really get the superstars to come over. That's been worth it. And then paying in a fairly meritocratic way that is largely formulaic based on client satisfaction and revenue, where we sort of say, like, no one's capped. Like, you can make infinite money here. Like, literally, like, it's like the thought that it's in people's power to create wealth and rewards based on their good work, I think is really important versus having folks feel mad that they've been, you know, capped and that they're being like exploited in some way. And we're kind of like, no, we're here to like help you make as much money as seemingly possible, not limit your potential. So I think that those are sort of client selection, hiring bar, and compensation transparency and meritocracy. Those were the good ones that I would have kept.
Thank you. And one final question, inflection points. So in terms of leadership teams, I mean, I see inflection points in terms of growth, but both in terms of your own company and other professional service firms, is it kind of the 30 people, 90 people, or 100 people? What are the big inflection points when it comes to leadership teams, do you think?
Sure. Yeah. Okay. In our industry, it sounds about right. Maybe in less than 30, like 10 or 12 people is different from like a 2 or 3 person ultra small boutique, like 2 or 3, like someone with a couple of colleagues. Like, there are a lot of those firms out there. So going from that to like 10, I think people, 10's an inflection point. Yeah. 90 or 100. Yeah. 10, 30, 90 to 100. And then 150, I think, are the inflection points where it just did seem like a different organism, you know, that needed different things. And then, you know, how to keep from this point forward a great culture as we expand geographically will be a big challenge. With Friend Center, we're, you know, paying very close attention to it. But I don't know what the next one was. I was talking to an investment banker yesterday who told me she thought after 150 people, like 1,000 was the next marker where it's a whole new ball game. And so, okay, well, that's good in that case. This current model's working pretty well. So we'll keep on trucking with 150 going to 1,000.
Good. Brilliant. Listen, Jeff, thank you. I could talk to you for hours, but I realize, you know, you're a busy guy. I could also talk, the listeners can't see them, but I could talk to you for hours about the books you've got behind you. They're a lot in common with book selections.
Well, yes, thank you. Yes, for as long as books are still going to be a medium for communication, I will buy them and read them. But yeah, it was a great pleasure talking with you, Joe. And yeah, we're happy to stay in touch here as we have a very similar overlapping mission, which is to help leaders be successful. I really find your work and research valuable. I always read what you're putting out. So keep up the great work on your side and stay in touch.
Thank you, Jeff. Take care.
Pleasure.
As ever, thank you for listening to the Consultancy Growth Podcast. This is Professor Joe Omani at joeomani.com.